Korean Fellowship in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and he is from Seoul, Korea. He's going to come at this time and share a word of testimony of his experience in Romania. Simon?
Before I went to Romania, I prayed a lot to God that I can be a blessing to those Christians in Romania. But while I was there, actually they were a blessing to me more than I was blessed to them. The place I went to was the Tulca, Romania, which was about 80 kilometers from Oradea, Romania. There are two things that I was very impressed with this church was that they had a wonderful young adults group that who loved the Lord very much. And especially they were musically very talented. And every night they gave us wonderful songs of praise. And most of their songs were from Psalms and scriptures. So it was practically speaking through the Word of God. Tuesday night that I went up there and sang in Korean and English a song. And they loved us so much that that night they asked me to teach them a Korean song. So I taught them a Korean song, and next day in choir, they sang in Korean, and that was a very wonderful thing. Second thing that I was very impressed with this church was that how hungry they were for the Word of God. The one thing that really amazed me was that even the small kid, even 10 years old boy, they could memorize so many Bible verses. It almost gave me a shame that I don't remember many Bible verses. And whenever that we shared our testimonies or our messages, they come to us and they gave us some scriptures that they learned from our sharings. So they memorized so many Bible verses, and that really gave them a strong witness to others. While I was there, I skipped almost like three meals at dinner time because the young adults, they keep asking me to stay and learn a little more about Bibles. So I skipped three meals and stayed with them about 1 or 2 hours more and shared their testimonies and Bibles. And it was so strange that I felt like I was not speaking through the translators, but somehow I felt like I was speaking right directly to them because they were receiving the everything that I was saying. So it was a very wonderful experience that I have. Since I came to America in 1981, my ministry is going really well because God is blessing me. And I thought that, wow, I can maybe settle down here and then financially very secure and then I might have some good mission ministry in America. But God really convicted my heart that I'm a simply pilgrim in this world and that I cannot stay any place because even Jesus was in the world, he didn't have any place to stay. So it really convicted my heart that I will open my door to God wherever he leads me that I wish to go. Thank you.
You know, God has such wonderful plans, doesn't he? Can you imagine sending a worker to Romania from Korea by way of North Carolina? I love it. And well, thank you so much, Simon, for a wonderful testimony today. I don't use this period to make many announcements, but once in a while I do need to call your attention to something. And after all, my primary function here is as minister of announcements. And it's not a bad thing to learn to do because a lot of you will serve in similar capacities in your churches from time to time. So let me just call your attention to the fact that in the news line that's available on the campus today, there are some very important pieces of information concerning a student forum on Friday with Zane Hodges over in the cafeteria, and also on the inside, a number of opportunities to hear him while he's here on campus as he answers the questions that you have always wondered about for your whole life long, namely the question about which Greek text is best, and also the question about which English translation is best. Joel, you're not trying to electrocute me, are you? All right. And so if you've always wondered which English text should I use and which Greek text is the best, and you want to hear Zane Hodges' persuasion on this, it will be a colorful presentation and you will enjoy it very much, and I would urge you to take advantage of that. Also, this is preliminary. I can't absolutely tell you for sure, but almost for sure, the following Friday, not this Friday, but the next Friday, we're also going to have a student forum, and it'll be a lion's den. I know some of you have heard about cost increases and that sort of thing. And so the natives are restless, and it's time for the meat to be made available to the lions. And so I am the meat. My hair is red for no reason at all, not for no reason at all. And so I'm going to go in the lion's den on next Friday, and so you be getting your questions ready on any subject you want to ask about, and we'll be ready for it on that occasion, okay? We'll even try to have some coffee and donuts or something over there for you at that time. Now let me tell you why I love Ken Hemphill. When he went to the First Baptist Church of Norfolk as pastor, I don't want you to imagine that this is intended as a negative statement about First Norfolk. It was a wonderful church, good church, sweet people. But I don't think most of the folks at First Norfolk would object to what I'm about to say about them when I say that they fell into what Vance Havner described as people that were singing Standing on the Promises when they were really just sitting on the premises. And that's not a cut down for the church. It's just the way that most of our churches are. We hit plateaus and we park there and we can't seem to generate the necessary spiritual power to get off the launch pad any further. And so at that point they call this young man, just a youth, but Dr. Ken Hemphill. Impeccable scholarly credentials. But what I like about him is that even with those scholarly credentials, his heart was ablaze to see people come to know Christ. And he went into a church situation where they weren't inclined to pick up on that immediately, but through the consistent preaching of the word, much prayer, what happened there is incredible. And God bless, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon the place, and they took off with their afterburners ignited, began in reaching people for Christ and growing and prospering in every way. And that's the work of God, not of Ken Hemphill, but God did need a messenger and a prophet, and he had one in this man. And so when he comes to talk to you today, he's coming to talk not as somebody off in an ivory tower writing about what he's observed statistically in church growth, but somebody who's walked into it and taken an old plateaued church and by the grace of God seen it work. You listen to this man this morning, whether you're in a small church running 30 in Sunday school, or whether you're, as is unlikely the case since you're here as a student right now, in a church running 3,000 in Sunday school, his message is for you this day. Ken Hemphill, we're glad to have you here. Come and speak to us today.
Well, thank you. And may I just give a word of affirmation. I have been thrilled with my 2 days on campus, and you folks may be in the process of setting the pace of making seminary again what it ought to be. I mean, there's a sense of revival on this campus, and walking in the classrooms, people praying that God would use this place to ignite not only this state but this nation for revival. And I know that the good news about what God is doing in Southeastern, and it's what God is doing here, is going to go out from this place. And I look forward next year when I'm on the campus. We're hoping to bring a full-blown church growth conference here that you can be a part of, and other pastors around here. And I hope that when I come to address this chapel, it's packed from side to side of new students and others who are coming here to hear what God is doing. After the issue of supernatural empowering and concerted prayer, what is the key factor of church growth? Most church growth writers almost entirely agree that the key critical issue after that is leadership. A sufficient kind of the right kinds of leaders. Beginning, of course, with the pastor. Now, the pastor is the leader of church growth is not an issue of status. It is not an issue of authority, but it's an issue of function. You see, when God gifted the body, he gave to that body gifted leaders, among which was the pastor teacher for the equipping of the saints for the work of ministry. That shouldn't surprise us. All great movements and ideas originate with the calling forth of a leader who has a dream, who communicates that dream and inspires others to join him in that dream. Now, the same is true throughout the Old and New Testament and in the church today. And so I want to look back in the Old Testament to the book of Nehemiah. And in that book, and we can't study the entire book together today, so I'm going to give you somewhat of a running outline, and I want to give you the 8 facets of visionary leadership. The 8 facets of visionary leadership. In Isaiah, we can't read all of it, but you remember that the message came down to him while he was a cupbearer for Nehemiah. And I'm going to begin in chapter 1, and they begin to tell him when he asked the question, how are folks doing back home? You see, he was isolated from the real conditions of what was taking place back in Jerusalem. And so he asked the question, how are things at home? And here's what they respond in verse 3. They said to me, the remnant there in the province who survived the captivity are in great distress and reproach. And the wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. And it came about that when I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days. And I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. And I said, I beseech thee, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who preserves the covenant and loving kindness for those who love and keep his commandment, let thine ear now be attentive and thine eyes open to hear the prayer of thy servant, which I am to praying before thee now night and day on behalf of the sons of Israel, thy servants, confessing the sins of the sons of Israel, which we have sinned against thee. I and my father's house, we have sinned. Principle number one, Nehemiah was a man who was willing to listen to God. When he heard about the conditions, his first response was to pray. Now, many of you are going to be given the opportunity to pastor a church where the walls are broken down, where there's discouragement, where few seem to have survived, and the first priority critical issue is going to be to listen to God. When Paul and I went to First Norfolk to deal with that pastoral search committee there, we looked at what had been happening over the past several years. The fire had burned the church back in 1970. They relocated in 1974. They had a spurt of growth up until about 1976. They had gotten to where they were running about 500 in Sunday school. And then they began a steady decline that had taken place for about 5 years. Until in 1981, when I came as the pastor there, they were down to about 380 average in Sunday school attendance. Many did not even know the conditions, but some did. And they remembered the good old days. They could remember when they were running 500. And many of you are going to have the privilege an opportunity of going into a church like that and be the instrument that God uses to turn it around. We had virtually determined that we would not take that church. We had talked about it, Paul and I, and we prayed about it. And we went one evening to a pulpit committee meeting, one of the last ones we were going to attend there, before we told them that evening that we did not feel led of God to come to that church. After the dinner, a strange thing occurred. We went out into a little sitting room there with the chairman of the pulpit committee, and he said, why don't we, before we begin to talk this evening, why don't we pray? Pretty good strategy, don't you think? Well, we assumed that it was going to be kind of the cursory prayer that we had done before, where we just kind of prayed a bit. But at about 1 in the morning, having started perhaps that evening about 8 or 9 o'clock, we got up off our knees and off our faces. And I realized and they realized that this was the place God had called me to be. Now, the church growth that happened in Norfolk over the 11 years that I was privileged to be the pastor, we went from 380 average attendance in Sunday school to around 2,200, about 6,000 members, baptizing over 200 a year in the state of Virginia. But the growth that I experienced, listen to me carefully, was the result of the seed that had been sown in prayer years before I ever came to be that pastor. There had been a faithful remnant, many of them senior adults, who had been praying that God would raise up a mighty church and a mighty leader that could take Norfolk and Virginia Beach with the gospel. And I am convinced to this day that it was that remnant, that prayer remnant, who had sown the seed that God gave me the privilege to reap the harvest of. Now, I want to tell you, wherever you go, no matter how bad the conditions may seem to be, I want to confirm it for you that there is somewhere in that church a prayer remnant. There are a group of people who have been praying that God would do a great and mighty work, and the first thing the leader must do is that he must listen to God. Now, when you move into that church, there are going to be all sorts of committees and groups that are going to tell you how you ought to run the church. There are all sorts of people that are willing to set an agenda for you. And they know you ought to start a singles ministry, or you ought to go reach the college kid, or you ought to start a military ministry, or whatever it is. And all of those may be good and wonderful ideas, but the key is you must first listen to God. Now, this necessitates that the man of God be a man of prayer. In this short book of Nehemiah, when you study it, there are 9 powerful prayers. This is the most difficult personal arena for the pastor. We get on the field and we got committees and we got stress and we got pressures and we've got deadlines and we got sermons to write and visits to make. The first thing that we often let slip is our own personal commitment, quiet time, prayer life with God. If you were to ask anybody on the staff of Dr. Charles Stanley what the key to his ministry is, I don't think anyone there would tell you anything different than what I'm going to tell you right now. Dr. Stanley is a man of prayer. Beyond everything else, you may say he's a great communicator of Scripture. That's true, but he is a man of prayer. Early in my own ministry, I took a trip to Ridgecrest for a Prayer for Spiritual Awakening conference. During that same time, God was doing a similar event in my own wife's life, and he brought that relationship together in that way. You need perhaps to use some tools like experiencing God or prayer life or watchman on the wall, but characteristically and primarily, you must be a person of prayer so that God can communicate to you. Facet number two, Nehemiah was willing to bear the burden for the walls. Once God gave to Nehemiah the burden that he had for the needs of the people, Nehemiah was willing to bear the burden for the wall. Look over in chapter 2. Nehemiah, who's the cupbearer, so he comes before the king, and the king always expects for Nehemiah to have a happy and joyous countenance. He certainly did not want to be taking his wine with a wine bearer who was always sullen and drab. And so in chapter 2, the king said to me, verse 2, "Why is your face sad, though you are not sick? Why, this is nothing but sadness of heart." You see, Nehemiah was so burdened for the cause of God that his heart was breaking within him, even so that a pagan king could see it. And so Nehemiah was very much afraid, and I said to the king, "Let the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tomb, lies desolate and its gates have been consumed by fire?" And this pagan king said, "What would you request?" You see, Nehemiah not only was listening to God, but he was willing to bear the burden for the wall. And people often ask, what is the source of vision? We talked about vision yesterday. I believe that vision comes from an encounter with God where God shares his burden for that community and that church with his man to lead that church. I believe that's where vision comes from. Only God can communicate that vision. God has a strategy for your church in your neighborhood to enable you to reach that community, and if you spend time listening to God, he will communicate that burden if you're willing to bear it. Leaders who grow great churches have a burden for unsaved people. I can remember on some of those early visits I was sharing with the class this morning. And when I came to Norfolk, we had no organized visitation program, and so one of the first things I did, I simply said to the deacons, I said, "Listen, I don't know where I'm going, and you probably don't know what to say, so I'll make a deal with you. You drive and pray, and I'll talk. That's all you have to do." So we'd pick up those visitors' cards, and we'd take off on several evenings a week, and we'd visit and pray together on the way. And there would be times, and in Virginia Beach at that time was growing so rapidly that we would drive into an area that I'd been into just a week or a month before, and all of a sudden it looked like the ground was sprouting mushrooms. You know these big yellow or big white PVC pipes that come sticking out of the ground when they're putting in a new community subdivision? And many times as we would drive through those subdivisions, without any intentionality, I would begin to weep audibly. And the deacon driving the car would say, "What in the world is wrong?" And God simply gave me a burden for the people that were going to be moving into those neighborhoods who were going to be lost. And that burden began to influence and impact those men who were driving me to those visits, because I had a willingness and a heart to bear the burden that God bore for that city that they might be saved. I'm now a member of First Baptist Church of Woodstock. Some of you know my pastor, Johnny Hunt, who is an alumnus of this institution. Johnny's a very gifted pastor, a very loving person, but if there's anything that drives that church, it is Johnny Hunt's burden for lost people. He has a passion in his heart that communicates every time he walks into the pulpit, anytime he meets with a committee, a senior adult group. It doesn't matter who he's meeting with or speaking to. You can sense and know that he has a burden for the entire community around that church that they might be saved. Nehemiah was willing to bear the burden. Number three, he was willing to dream a great dream. Look at verse 5 in that same chapter. "And I said to the king, 'If it please the king, and if your servant has found favor before you, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it.'" What an audacious dream. Here an entire nation virtually had moved back, and they had not been able to accomplish the rebuilding of the wall. If you've ever been over there to Jerusalem and you see the incredible proportion of that wall, you know what a task he was undertaking to rebuild this wall. And his dream simply is, "If you'll send me back, I'll rebuild the wall." Now, Nehemiah had already encountered God, and so he knew that God had already promised, because the phrase you find repeated throughout this book is "the great and awesome God." Nehemiah was not being arrogant in saying, "I can rebuild that wall." He was saying, "God's already given me the burden to rebuild that wall, and he wants to rebuild that wall, and I'll be the man that God could use to do so." Nehemiah had a tremendous dream. Most critical need of most churches is to dream a great dream. I shared the story of Wolf Creek yesterday and that dream, the dream night. When we came to Norfolk, and Sunday school had been plateaued, declining. We didn't have any staff. I know some of you said, well, it'd be easy to grow a church with a big staff like you folks had. I had one staff person when I came. Soon after I came, he left. I went to Ridgecrest with one of my lay people who was our Sunday school director. We went down there to a basic conference, a growth spiral conference, if you ever heard of one, with Andy Anderson. We looked at that conference and what it explained about how you grow the church through the Sunday school, just basic principles of church growth. And we were on the way back, and this layman looked at me and he said, Pastor, what do you think we ought to do? And I said, I don't know anything to do except what he said. Why don't we go back home and let's set some goals this year for baptisms, enrollment, and attendance, and let's put these goals up in front of all of our people. He said, that sounds like a great idea. So he came back all excited out of that conference and messages I'd been preaching on vision and dreaming a dream. He went to all of his lay leadership, brought all those leaders in, said, okay, in your youth class, you've got 12 people enrolled. How many next year do you think you can have enrolled by this time? They said, oh, we think we can have 16. He went to the next class, and so he accumulated all these, and he brought them and laid them on my desk, and he said, Pastor, next year our goal for net enrollment gain is 860 people. Now, at that time, we only had about 1,100-something enrolled. This was a 68% goal for growth. Well, I was young and naive, and I didn't know you couldn't do that. I had no idea. That was too audacious a dream. And so I got this big piece of a poster paper, and I went out in the lobby of First Norfolk, and I had a guy to draw up this tremendous goal, 68% growth goal. Now, first of all, that was a shocker because they had never had a poster out in the lobby of the First Baptist Church. So when they complained about it, all I did was lower it so they'd have to stoop to get under it to get in. I wanted them to see that goal. I wanted to keep that vision, that dream, that goal in front of our people. Then all of a sudden, I started getting newsletters from around the convention, and they were setting their goals for Sunday school growth, and they were 4, 5, 10%, and I'm looking 68%, and I'm looking at this thing. And finally, I got one, and it was 11%. That was the highest one. This guy was saying, this is the highest goal in the history of our church. It was about the same size as our church. I called the Sunday school director in. I said, brother, what do you think you are doing with the underline on you? He said, well, Pastor, what do you mean? I said, well, look at this. And I hand him all these bulletins. He'd read 4, 11. He'd just kind of smile. He said, well, so what? So what? We've got 68%. He said, well, Pastor, you said to dream a great dream. I said, brother, I was just preaching when I said that. You got to be careful when you're just preaching, because he took me seriously. Well, you know what happened that year? First Baptist Church in Norfolk that year enrolled net over 1,000 people. We nearly doubled. Now, I know what you're thinking. Well, of course, the whole area up there was growing. Well, do you know that the number one association in the entire state that year was up around Washington, D.C., and they enrolled about 1,100. Our association was number two, and they enrolled about 1,000. And of the 1,000, we enrolled about 1,040 of them. You say, wait a minute, your math is off. No, I'm not. 59 other churches enrolled a minus 40 the same year we enrolled 1,000. Now, the reason was there was a dream, a vision that dared to believe that God could. Facet number four, Nehemiah was willing to share his vision with the people. You know, I spend a lot of time with pastors today, and I rarely encounter a pastor who does not have a vision and a dream for his church. And they'll sit down and explain to me with tears running down their face what they would like to see God do and what they believe God can do in their church. And then if I speak with their people, oftentimes their people do not know or share that same dream because the pastor has never communicated, he's never shared his heart with his people. The people in your church need to know your heart. They need to know the what and the why. Not just what the numbers are, but why. And the answer is because people are lost. Your people do not respond necessarily to numerical goals. You see, they don't have to go to the pastor's conference on Tuesday and brag about it. What they respond to is lost people. A regenerate church that has a touch of God is going to be moved by the plight of lost people. Church growth is not a numbers game for numbers' sake. Church growth is about reaching unsaved people. The only way you're going to grow your church is through evangelism, because that's the only way you're going to add people to the kingdom of God. So Nehemiah was willing to share his vision. Look at chapter 2, verse 17. Then I said to them, do you see the bad situation we are in? That Jerusalem is desolate and its gates are burned by fire. Come, let us. You see, all of a sudden he said, I'm going to rebuild the wall, and now it's changed. He said, let us
rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, that we may no longer be a reproach. And I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me, and also what the king had said to me, and they said, let us arise and build. You see what Nehemiah did? He shared his vision. He shared his passion. He said, here's what God has already done. Here's how God has confirmed this. This is my heart. This is what God has directed us to do. And here how God has put his affirmation on it. Facet number 5. Nehemiah had a strategy for accomplishing the vision. You see, vision is wishful thinking until it's coupled with a strategy for execution. Now, a lot of guys have a dream. They say to me, well, my dream is to see our Sunday school double in 2 years. My dream is to move from 12 baptisms a year to 25 baptisms a year. And I say, wonderful, that's a great dream. How do you plan to accomplish that? What is your strategy for accomplishing that? What are you sharing with your people to enable them to do that? What is your intentional plan of evangelism? And they go, oh, I thought the dream was enough. You see, a vision without a strategy is wishful thinking. Now look at the strategy over in chapter 4, verse 15. Now, when our enemies heard that it was known to us that God had frustrated their plan. Now remember, when he started working, the enemies came. We're going to talk about that in a minute. It came about that from that day on, that half of the servants carried on the work while half of them held the spears, the shields, the bows, the breastplates. The captains were behind the whole house of Judah. There were those who were rebuilding the wall, those who carried the burdens. They took their load with one hand doing the work and the other hand holding a weapon. As for the builders, each wore his sword girded at his side as he built, while the trumpet stood near me. And I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, the work is great and extensive, and we are separated on the wall from one another. Whatever place you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally there, and our God will fight for us. So we carried on the work with half of them holding spears from dawn until the stars appeared. And that time I said to the people, let each man with his servants spend the night within Jerusalem so that they may be a guard for us by night and a laborer by day. So neither I, my brothers, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us removed our clothes. Each took his weapon even to the water. His strategy was simple. We're going to have everybody to work. We're going to stand united. When some are working, if there's battle, half are going to hold the shields. And we will never, never leave the wall for the battle. Now that is more critical than you think. Oftentimes, what happens in a local church when it begins to grow is that somebody's going to create conflict. And the adversary is going to use somebody in that church. It may be one of the deacons, it may be someone else, to stir up conflict. And oftentimes what we do is we climb down from the wall of the Great Commission to fight the battles over our reputation. And Nehemiah simply refused to climb down. In fact, when they came to him and called him to climb down so that they could negotiate, he said, I'm doing a great work and I will not come down from the wall. Oftentimes we lose the vision and we leave the building for the distracting battles in our church or our community. It was amazing how many people in Norfolk had an agenda for me. You know, they just knew what we ought to do in the life of the church, and many of them were good things that new people needed to be involved in as God led them to do so, whether they were issues of abortion or whatever it was. And I said, folks, our first priority is to fulfill the Great Commission. We must, by every effort within us, confront every person in this community with the gospel, and God's going to change many of their lives, and some of you are gifted to do other things, and if God leads you to do that, you go do it with my blessings. But this church is going to forever focus on the priority of presenting the gospel to every person in Tidewater until not one remains lost. And we're not going to climb down from that wall to fight other battles. When the conflict begins to emerge, have a strategy, have a plan. Do you have a strategy? Do your people clearly understand it? Have you been willing to communicate it? Facet number 6. Nehemiah endured and made it happen. No matter what your dream, no matter how noble it is, somebody won't like it. Look at chapter 4. Now it came about that when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became furious and very angry, and he mocked the Jews. And he spoke in the presence of his brothers. Now, what amazes you is you'd think everybody would be for rebuilding the wall. I mean, this is for everybody's good. Why would anybody get mad?
And what amazes a lot of young pastors, you go into a church and the church starts growing and there's new life and you begin to baptize people and you're absolutely floored because some of the people begin to get angry because the church is growing. You see, when folks are either unregenerate or unrevived, one or the other, and they see the hand of God in their church, they're intimidated because they fear they're going to lose their authority, their clout, or their influence, and they will try to create dissension. And notice when he complained, he always complained in the presence of somebody else. You ever notice how people are in your church? They never come to you privately and say, "Pastor, I'm really concerned about this, and I just want us to pray about it." They always complain in the presence of somebody else. It's the most amazing thing. And so he spoke in the presence of his brothers and the wealthy men of Samaria. It's amazing sometimes how the folks who have means and influence in your church become the detractors to what God is doing. And they threaten to withdraw their tithe if you don't slack off in this. You've been there, have you? Now, then they say, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Are they going to restore it for themselves? Can they offer up sacrifices? Can they finish in a day? Can they revive the stones from the dust, the rubble, even the burdened ones?" Now Tobiah the Ammonite was near, and he said, "Why, even what they are building, if a fox should jump on it, he would break their stone wall down." You see what they did? They tried the childish taunting. They attempted to create distrust among the people. Later on, he's going to attempt to create distrust by putting out a rumor that Nehemiah wanted to set himself up to be the king. He questioned the leader's integrity. Folks, you're going to encounter every one of those when your church starts growing. There are going to be those that begin a whisper campaign. There are going to be those who try to manipulate through finances and money. There are going to be those that will question your integrity and say, "Well, this guy just wants to rule the church. He just wants to be the king. That's all he's interested in. Nehemiah has no interest in the community. He wants to be the ruler." Folks, I want you to realize all these things are going to happen. You're surprised to find, by the way, that the most persistent discouragement did not come from without the Samaritans. It came from within. Look down in verse 10. "Thus in Judah, it was said," they created a little song, a taunt song, "the strength of the burden bearers is failing, yet there's much rubbish, and we ourselves are unable to rebuild the wall." How would you feel if your Sunday school leadership started singing that song to you? In fact, it says they said it 10 times over. You ever notice that sometimes the people who affirm you say it 1 time, but the people who want to destroy you will say it 10 times over? Now, in the midst of all that, Nehemiah endured and finished the wall. I think a lot of pastors leave on the verge of victory. It's amazing to me. Have you ever had one of those things when somebody would hand you a jar, your wife usually, and wants you to get the top off of it? And you're kind of a macho man, you don't want to fail, and you sit there and grin, and then you grimace, and sweat pops out, and you say, "Well, you know," and you beat it, and you just do everything, and then you hand it back to her, and she goes, "Oh, yeah." Now, you say, "Well, I got it loose." Now, the truth is, you'd have gotten it the next time yourself if you had endured. And it's amazing how many pastors are in situations where if they simply stayed because God had placed them there and endured, the lid was ready to come off. Now, the seventh thing is that Nehemiah always focused on the great and awesome God. Nehemiah refused to defend himself. He refused to take up the sword and come down from the wall. And here's what he said. Up in verse 14, "Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses." He always pointed them back to God. He said, "This is not our battle. You remember the man who sent us here, the God who called us to this task, and that he is a great and awesome God, and he is sovereignly in control. And God is going to work good in the midst of every situation. You remember him. Point your people who follow you to the great and awesome God." Number 8, Nehemiah led the people in celebration. Now, this is all of chapters 8 and 9. After the wall is built, they begin to dance and sing. There on the wall, they lead in celebration. I think sometimes what we fail to do as pastors is we fail to pause and to celebrate and to give thanks, to have adequate time to worship God and thank the people. I mean for the little victories. Man, when you're in the midst of this struggle to see God build His church through you, and you've got all the flack and all the conflict coming, folks, one of the things you need to spend plenty of time doing is celebrating the victories that God gives. Even if it's a little victory, man, you bring it to the pulpit and say, look what God has done this week. When that child walks down the aisle, celebrate that victory. Whatever begins to take place, point your people to the great and awesome God and help them celebrate the victory. And those who stand with you, you put a hand on the shoulder and thank them personally and say, thank you for what God's called you to do. Affirm them in the task that God's led you to do. A great leader leads in celebration and praise.
Well, Ken Hemphill, we thank you so much, and we're going to be looking forward to next year when we have the Church Growth Conference here, and we'll be having a revival in the fall, and then in the spring, the Church Growth Conference, and be looking forward to God doing some wonderful things on both occasions. Now, here's what I want you to do today instead of having a benediction as such. Take your hymn book, please, and turn to page 586. We've got our organist still here, I believe. We started out this morning singing, We Have a Story to Tell to the Nations, and frankly, you didn't sound much like you'd tell it next door, let alone to the nations. And Dr. Ken Hemphill has challenged us this morning to do this. We're going to sing just the first verse, and that'll be our dismissal today. But this time, let's sing it like we intended to do it, okay? 586, stand with us, please, as we sing.